I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kids play sports, and that means injuries. While most get off with some scrapes and bruises, sometimes it's serious. Today, as part of our Childhood Development series, we'll talk about what to do when your kid gets hurt, both on and off the field. From the helmets we use to lack of sleep, we'll look at what can be done to avert children's sports injuries. Also, we'll review the American Academy of Pediatrics' latest recommendations for preventing sleep-related infant deaths. Finally, this week's Local Listen with Bill Brownlee. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's late October, which means the World Series in full swing, and football season has kicked off. For the pros, collisions and repetitive stress on the field has been shown to play a havoc on even the ablest of bodies. But for kids who play sports, injuries can lead to long-term disabilities. Today, as part of our Childhood Development series, we'll talk about sideline injuries, how to prevent them, and what to do if your kid is injured on or off the field. Joining us today is Dr. Greg Canty. He's Medical Director of the Center for Sports Medicine at Children's Mercy Hospital. Dr. Canty, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
Pediatrician Natasha Burgert of Pediatric Associates of Kansas City is also back with us. Dr. Burgert, welcome back.
Hi, Steve.
Okay. Well, just for a minute, Dr. Natasha, I want to bench our conversation about sports injuries and look at new recommendations to help prevent sudden infant death syndrome, also known as SIDS. This new recommendation might alter a few plans out there. What is it?
Well, there's new guidelines that came out on Monday. This is a revision of the policy that the American Academy of Pediatrics had released in 2011. And what the policy is telling us is first some basics. We have to reinforce our basics, which is how to keep our kids safe when they sleep. And for the Academy guidelines that most are familiar with, we know that A-level recommendations include putting your kids on their back to sleep, even if they have reflux, don't put them on their side, putting them in a flat, boring, and bare place. But what's a little bit new and more prominent in this report than it has been in the past is keeping them as a roommate for a longer period of time.
And this is the one that's going to jar people here.
Yeah,
a bit.
So the Academy is now recommending that parents share a room, not a bed, but share a room space with an infant for 6 to 12 months. This is for a couple of different reasons. We think, we know that the greatest risk of SIDS is during the first 6 months of life, so this is the protective time to keep an infant close. But we also think that the normal sounds and the normal movements that an infant makes and that a family makes kind of keeps each other a little bit more alert, keeps them in a lower a higher sleep state, not getting into that deep sleep that we worry about getting causing our infants trouble. So this is a new concept. Most families are very looking forward to putting them in a beautiful baby nursery, but I think I think that might be the thing of the past, and we're now thinking about just bringing home a roomie and making sure that they have a nice place in our bedrooms to sleep.
Well, this means less sleep for adults, though, doesn't it?
You know, potentially so. I mean, a lot of babies are certainly
Dr. Canty's
yes, I know.
Head,
I mean, a lot of babies certainly grunt and they make noise when they sleep. But what we're thinking is this might be protective. And I have a lot of, you know, SIDS really scares a lot of families. They're really worried about this. And if there's anything that we can do to prevent it, we need to do it. And I think what makes parents miss more sleep is worrying that their kid is not sleeping in a safe space or putting them in a position where they know that they're at risk. So hopefully these new recommendations will let parents sleep soundly, knowing they've done the best they can to prevent this ultimate tragedy.
What do we know, Natasha, about SIDS today that we didn't know 5 or 10 years ago? Are we progressing?
We are progressing. You know, I think that these SIDS researchers are working tirelessly to try to work on this problem. But what has happened is, even after the back to sleep campaign in the late 80s, we've seen a significant reduction in the amount of SIDS, which is really, really great news. The problem is still 3,500 kids die every year of SIDS.
Yeah.
And a large percent of those are due to suffocation and asphyxiation. These are what these SIDS guidelines are preventing against. But they've done tremendous work in the field of cardiac defects, genetic defects, other components that can be part of this problem.
Okay. Well, let's take a look now at some recent developments in treating the sports injuries of our kids. Dr. Kenty, we used to have kids play, you know, different sports throughout the year, but there's this trend these days to push young people into one particular sport. Is early sports specialization a problem as far as you're concerned?
Definitely.
Really?
I think you can see from a number of the national sports medicine societies that have all released statements in the past few years talking about the dangers of early sports specialization.
The dangers like what?
The biggest danger we see, or really a couple of things. One, I talk to families, what are your goals with early sports specialization? Most families think they want to produce a better athlete, but the studies easily show that starting in early sports specialization does not lead to better outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Better outcomes actually are developed through some what we call sports diversification, particularly when you're young, developing skills that you probably wouldn't get from over-specializing in one sport. And most organizations now aren't recommending sports specialization before the ages of 14 to 15, which, to be honest, is quite rare in my practice. It's unusual for me to see a family in my office that is younger than that. I mean, I guess I should say it's not uncommon for me to see somebody as young as 9, 10, 12 that have already specialized in one sport, and I find that particularly alarming.
And that's this notion that if we specialize early on, perhaps we can produce an Olympic champion down the road.
Correct.
Yeah.
And since we're talking a little bit, you know, my practice extends from a lot of the junior high school up into the college age athlete. And so, but when you take a look at how those folks develop, that early specialization doesn't pay off in the long run. And it's really hard to predict when someone's 10 or 11 what they're going to be great at when they're 15 or 16.
And what's the problem when it comes to injuries then, doctor? Repetitive motion injuries. Are you mm-hmm. seeing some of that when kids mm-hmm. specialize in one sport over another?
Oh, definitely. What we see the most of is when you think of how does a 15-year-old athlete differ from a 25-year-old Royals or Chiefs player? Well, the 15-year-old athlete still has a very developing skeleton. So if you look at just bony anatomy, the bone's not completely developed yet. They still have a growth plate. Those bones are continuing to evolve. They have immature cartilage, and doing the same motion over and over and over again leads to wear down. And you know, I like to use Lorenzo Cain was quite popular in the last couple of years, and I like to use him as an example of someone who didn't really start playing baseball specifically until he was much older in his high school age. And it's a great local example of someone who's promoted, really, sports diversification.
What about the psychological effects, Greg, of kids who specialize in one sport? I'm wondering about burnout, kids get tired of just playing one sport over and over and over again.
Well, that's what we're seeing, and I think it all ties together. Sports specialization and burnout, we think, may be closely related together. And what you see if you have young athletes that start playing when they're young, they don't develop other skill sets, they don't get exposure to other sports, and sometimes these are what I call those early developers. Those are those 12-year-olds who, you know, look like they shaved before they came to the office. Mm-hmm. And so you get somebody who's very physically mature, as the other kids may catch up when they're 14 or 15. If this athlete hasn't been exposed to other sports, hasn't played other sports, and all of a sudden they're not quite the star they used to be just because of physical development, there's pressure on them. They already feel pressure because they've had success in the past. They don't have another skill set to transfer to. And so what happens is they get burnt out and they just quit playing. And as much as we see rising participation rates in youth athletes where it feels like everybody's spending every Saturday at a soccer field, we're seeing increasing numbers of burnout and people just checking out of sports when they're 13 or 14. And I think when you look as a...
You've just had enough.
Yeah. And when we look at this as a society and a public health initiative, you know, we have to think about what are our goals. Are our goals to raise Olympic athletes, which is a lot of genetics, you know?
Yeah.
Or is our goal to raise healthy adults and healthy teenagers, healthy college-age students that are physically active, enjoying sports as a way of physical activity, and developing in just a happy people that use physical activity as a way to maintain their health. And I think that's what our goal should be. But we've lost a little bit of that focus, I believe, in the past kind of generation.
Well, a little bit or a lot, depending on your point of view. Natasha, what are you seeing in your practice when it comes to kids and sports injuries and this whole specialization thing?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of kids. Certainly early, I can't agree with Dr. Kenny Moore. Specifically, I see a lot of female athletes in my practice, specifically in gymnastics and swim and cheer. And these girls get burned out. They have changes in their development. I certainly have some kids that by the time the money hits the road, by the time those late high school years come around, they're not interested anymore.
Wow. And they're just done.
They're just done.
Wrapping it up.
Yeah.
How about the repetitive sports injury aspect of this? What are you seeing on that front?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of knee and hip injuries specifically is what I see the most. Certainly my softball players have upper arm extremity injuries as well. But again, I think part of the challenge there is they want to be a good teammate. They know that they're going to have to play when they're not 100%. They keep playing out there. They want to participate. And kind of the story that we tell in our office, or certainly what I tell these girls, is to be a good teammate. You got to stay on the field and perform your best. And sometimes that means taking a few days off.
Yeah.
Excellent advice.
Well, what we're talking about here is a culture that's just gone nuts when it comes to kids and sports, Greg. Am I gathering that correctly?
I believe so. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's easy to say everyone's gone nuts, but I think everyone's well-intentioned. I think that's the problem, is we need to spread the word a little bit more about education, how we approach it as a society and a culture. And obviously, I practice sports medicine. I see many of the wonderful benefits of sports. If you look at adolescents that participates in sports, they're more likely to go to college, less likely to have alcohol and drug abuse, less likely to have teenage pregnancy, mm-hmm. and they're more likely to do better in school. So all those old kind of theories about the so-called dumb jock just don't hold true. So there's so many benefits to youth sports. But I think we have to keep in mind, what are our goals? Understanding that a lot of sports success is tied into, as Dr. Natasha and I were joking about, it's tied into genetics, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Mom and dad are an accountant. You might be a sports superstar. But if you look at some of the data from the NCAA, the best predictor of who's going to get that elusive college scholarship, it really happens in less than 2% of high school varsity athletes. Your best predictor is, did mom, dad, or one of your immediate family members play a college sport? At the end of the day, we don't want to drive your body into the ground practicing over and over. We can just blame mom and dad.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Natasha, I'm wondering, you know, that there are these mixed messages here. We're talking about overdoing it at the same time that we're facing this epidemic of a lack of physical fitness in so many of our kids. We want to emphasize that. But then again, when organized sports leagues are starting at age 4, 5, and 6, you just sort of wonder what's going on out there. I've always wondered, my kids, when they were in kindergarten and first grade and the dads were organizing soccer leagues, I just remember thinking, you got to be kidding. Know what a ball is yet.
No,
you know?
It's totally true. And I think at those early stages, certainly it can be fun, and that early exposure is fun. But I think it crosses the line when kids start to come into me and say, you know, coach doesn't make it fun anymore, or mom and dad keep yelling at me about this and really, really causing some changes. We want our kids to learn early skill sets. We want them to be able to perform in these places. I think it's a good place for them to meet new friends and to kind of bond with their peers. But there does seem to be a line that we shouldn't cross.
Mm-hmm. How often do you come across kids, Greg, who have suffered one type of sports-related injury or another and wind up moving away from organized sports altogether? You referred to that already. Mm-hmm. How common is it?
I don't think we have great numbers, but I think when you look at the teenage athlete, it's quite common. Oftentimes they get an injury. That's a very challenging psychological recovery, not just a physical recovery, but we have to remember these are developing young athletes, not just physically, but also mentally, emotionally, intellectually, how they're integrating with their peers. They get hurt. And that's one of the other advantages to sports diversification, is that if they get hurt playing one sport and they're removed from that sport, they oftentimes lack a great peer network to hang out with, because all of their peers have been spent on travel teams and going here and going there. And so this diversification is probably important, not just for physical means, but also for a kid's emotional development and well-being. And I think that's important.
How about young kids who suffer a debilitating sports-related injury that ends their athletic careers? How often are you seeing that?
I think that part, as far as a debilitating injury where you can't return to any sport, is quite rare. Mm-hmm. I think you can return. In today's world, our medicine continues to improve. You know, ACL injuries, which we see an epidemic of, you can return from most sports injuries. Now, whether you can return to perform at the level you competed at before might be a different question for some of these severely injured athletes, or whether you want to continue in a sport that may have led to an overuse injury is probably the bigger question.
Yeah.
And I think Dr. Natasha touched on a little bit earlier too, I think the thing we're trying to promote recently at the American Academy of Pediatrics, I'm on the Council of Sports Medicine and Fitness, and one of our big emphasis on this year's meeting was developing physical literacy.
Mm.
And so the first thing people would look at me and say, what do you mean physical literacy?
You took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah. And so physical literacy is basically the definition I pulled up here just so I got it exactly correct is what we're using is it's called the motivation, confidence, physical competence, knowledge, and understanding to value and take responsibility for engagement in physical activities for life. So that's a mouthful. But when you look at it, we think about physical literacy being just as important as reading literacy. When we read, we build up on that skill set. You start off reading a small book. You develop into reading a novel. Well, we should probably take a look at sports and physical activity the same. Teaching people to start off with learning how to properly throw, run, jump, land. We think learning how to do these things properly, which comes from playing multiple sports,
right,
leads to someone having better physical literacy so that if you do get injured as an adolescent athlete, you do have a severe injury, you have the skill set at that point to pick up another physical activity so that as a result of that, you remain physically active for life. Your physical activity is not tied into just one sport.
Yeah.
It's a mind frame. It's a lifestyle that you can transfer.
Natasha, how often are you coming across debilitating injuries that maybe might even limit someone's athletic career going forward?
We certainly see that quite a bit. Really, truly debilitating injuries, I agree with Dr. Canty, are rare. But what I find interesting and practically with working with these kids is after they really have a significant injury, end up requiring surgery, for example, a lot of them have a fear factor almost. Like, I don't want to get myself into that position again. And so I really feel uncomfortable going back on the soccer field. I'm not going to give it 100% because if that happens to my knee again, and I know the surgery and how much pain it was and how the therapy was, and I agree with Dr. Caney as well, they don't have another thing to do. They end up sitting on the sidelines for quite some time, I think more emotionally than physically. We also worry about kids getting depressed for the same reasons of the psychosocial development that are so important. They're missing their friends. They're missing their routine. They start to possibly gain weight or have changes to their body that they're not aware of that make them upset. So I think the biggest thing that we can do as parents and as care providers is recognize when kids are getting extreme and try to prevent as best as we can these overuse injuries through different techniques and time off.
We're talking about sports injuries among our kids this morning with Dr. Greg Canty with Children's Mercy, pediatrician Natasha Burgert of Pediatric Associates. If you have a question, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Greg, so what's the most common debilitating injuries that you're coming across these days?
I think when you're talking about the most common debilitating injuries, we're still, when you talk sports, the most common ones are going to be knee and ankle injuries because it spreads the gamut of almost all sports. And that we see knee, ankle, followed that, probably by shoulder. We see so many overhead sports these days between baseball throwers with the popularity of the Royals.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen a lot more throwing injuries in the past 2 years as the Royals have been more successful. Kids want to, they want to emulate their heroes. And so they're practicing more, playing more, which is probably leading to a little bit of an increased epidemic in upper extremity injuries, particularly the elbow and throwing athletes.
Natasha, how about you? What are you seeing? What are the most common things you're seeing?
The common things that I see in my office are just simply overuse.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're just working too hard. Their body's getting stressed, and it's starting to break down. And like Dr. Canty alluded to, I think we really have to recognize that we're not trying to push a mature skeleton. We're not trying to push a mature body through really vigorous activities. And kids are strong, and they can do it. And kids need to get out there and challenge themselves. But when you do have physical limitations based on your development as a child, they have to be respected.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation about sports injuries among our kids. We'll talk about concussions. We'll talk about ACLs. We'll talk about the psychology of sports and a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, the County Election Board told us how they ensure fair and free voting. And we heard the story of Lloyd Gaines, whose Supreme Court case advanced civil rights in the U.S. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, we'll speak with Missouri Senator Roy Blunt, who's locked in a tight battle for re-election with Democrat Jason Kander. Tomorrow, here on Up to Date. Well, this hour we're talking about childhood sports injuries, what to do about them, how to deal with them. Dr. Greg Canty is here with Children's Mercy Hospital. Pediatrician Natasha Burgert of Pediatric Associates is also back with us again. What about this notion, Greg, you want to emphasize skill development, and you wanted to talk about that a little bit. What do you mean, skill development in place of what?
Well, I think we see a lot of youth sports now emphasize competition, where we're competing, we're playing in multiple games in a weekend, we're traveling here, and then it starts young. You know, I have a brother that lives in Alabama, and, you know, there's pressure for his 7-year-old athletes to, you know, he has a son that's very, very gifted, and they want to travel here and play multiple games on a weekend. But if you take a look, as we've talked a little bit about, just like I said, childhood development, sports development, is it's very clear when you poll younger children and adolescents, that fun's a big part of their game. And what we should really be focusing on is probably less competition, less spending excessive money on travel, and more just on skill development. Mm-hmm. And working on, that means more practice than play. That ratio of practice to play is a little bit reversed. And I think that's one of the things that's leading to burnout injuries and parental burnout. And let's face it, youth sports are expensive now. Mm-hmm. And if you really want your kid to excel, you should probably stop spending, you know, up to $10,000 a year just on travel and leagues and games, and really focus your team on good skill development, because that's how you're eventually going to have success. And I think those kids less than 12, practice should be the biggest majority of what they're doing, developing their skills, and less on travel and competition over and over. As they develop into the adolescent, high school age athlete, competition, the psychology behind competition, then becomes a little bit more of an emphasis. But on younger athletes, it really should be focused on skill development.
Natasha, you know, two factors that oftentimes get overlooked in all this, nutrition and sleep. A lot of kids, we've talked about it on the show any number of times, they don't get enough sleep. Talk to us about nutrition and sleep when it comes to our young athletes.
When we talk about athletes, and particularly student athletes, it's always kind of my mantra that your school is your job, and that's going to be most important, and sports are a privilege. And in order to optimize all of those different areas, we have to think about the basics. And when we're thinking about specialization and extra practices and all this kind of stuff, we kind of sacrifice some of those basics that we know are super important. So, you know, eating 3 meals a day, still getting your protein, a nice balance of carbohydrates, still eating a ton of variety of vegetables, different colors, challenging yourself to try new things are super important for our athletes. Smaller meals, perhaps throughout the day, having snacks in their bags, making sure they're getting fuel in order to perform at these levels. If you don't have fuel, you can't play. It's the gas in your tank, and we got to put it there. And we also really have to prioritize sleep. Sleep is where our bodies repair. That's where they rest. That's where we create memories. We create muscle memories. We've got to prioritize that as a society, as a family, and certainly with our athletes. And as a reminder, most preteens and teens need about 8 to 10 hours a day. And I would make an argue some of my athletes even need closer to that 10 hours in order to repair after these huge mega sessions with these multiple games. And that's a lot. And it needs to be a priority in order for that to have a repair that we need.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Lori from Kansas City, Missouri. Lori, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, good afternoon, or good morning, I guess. I'm calling. I have two boys, 11 and 13, who are pretty athletic and identified as being rather talented. And they play multiple sports, which I've advocated since the beginning. But they predominantly play a lot more of, let's say, tennis and soccer. My question is there a best practices number or site or recommendation for how often they should practice and train? And then in addition to that, how much time they should spend, stay in the gym, doing physio, sort of body resistance, not weight training necessarily. And then I have a second question, which is, should I preemptively take them to a doctor? They see their pediatrician once a year, but should I take them preemptively to see if their feet are fine, their legs are fine, their knees are fine, et cetera, and not just the cursory you know, you can play sports exam that they do, you know, to get a permission slip.
Lori, hang on to make sure I cover all your questions here. What about the notion of putting numbers on practice time and everything else that Lori's asking about, Greg?
So I think when you take a look at recommendations, the recommendations are for each sport, you should build in 2 to 3 months of time away from that sport throughout the year. So that's when you take a look at your annual calendar. That doesn't mean they have to be 2 to 3 in a row, but that means I may take a month here and a month there. I like for those times off to be in month-long increments, though, not a week here, week there, week here. Try to make it a month long to allow that body to recover. Particularly, you know, tennis and soccer both have their share of overuse injuries. Great, wonderful sports, but you have to plan how you're going to do that. And so I recognize that. The other thing I advocate for youth athletes taking at least one day off a week to recover. I think that if you have a youth athlete, there's a lot of things that are important in their life. They should be able to take one day off of their sport to allow their body to completely recover.
What about
those are my general recommendations.
The notion that Lori asked Natasha about this idea of preemptively going to the doctor to check feet and joints and make sure everything's functioning okay.
I don't think, you know, the challenge when you take them to the doctor, of course, is that I'm not able to actually see them when they are doing their work. And so being able to identify challenges with their biomechanics or something with their joints, for example, is really hard to tell in clinic unless you have an injury. So I think that might be a better question to the coaches and the other athletes and the other people that are supporting these teams to actually see them in their field of play, watching their biomechanics, what kind of other preventative measures, whether physical therapy type maneuvers and prevention techniques are happening. And that certainly doesn't happen in my office. I'd love to hear Dr. Canty's opinion of that as well.
Yeah, Greg, weigh in here.
I think what I tell people a lot of is that I'm not for sure that you have to come in to be evaluated, because just as Dr. Natasha spoke of, it's a little hard to assess some of those in the office, though in a sports practice we have equipment and things that we can do that. The other thing with technology I advocate for families is, if you have concerns about the way they're moving, almost everybody has a phone on them now. Pick up the video camera, videotape them doing something that concerns you. Next time you're in seeing your physician, talk to them a little bit about, you know, I noticed this, here's a 15-second clip, and you can then see that athlete on the field. You can get a feel for, are they doing something wrong? But most of the time, I agree in that those things can be worked out with your coaches, strength trainers, and I'm not for sure that there's always a high value in something other than a very thorough, well-developed physical in your medical home. And if your physician then has a question about that, I think escalating that to someone else who may have a little more expertise in those movement patterns is probably the best way to go.
I hope that helps, Lori.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Yeah. Let's go to Laura from Kansas City, Missouri. Laura, good morning.
Good morning. I was really surprised to find out that our school district no longer teaches sports in their PE program.
So what do they do?
Unless they teach fitness.
Ah.
So it's all exercise-based, and any exposure to sports that kids have, parents are paying for.
Okay. What do you make of that, Dr. Canty?
Yeah, I guess I have a few mixed feelings about that. One is, in some ways, I think it's great in that if they're increasing, again, that physical literacy term we talked about of how to move, how to enjoy physical activity, how to do something that you can carry into adulthood other than just a team sport that you're more likely to give up as an adolescent. So I like the fact that you're developing different skills. However, if you look at adolescents that reach physical activity guidelines, most of the ones that are reaching it are involved in sports. And so I still would encourage sports being a part of PE. And I think you just have to have a broad scope of things you hope to achieve and cover there. I think the advent, it's a mixed bag. You know, Steve, I know you do a lot of politics. And so when you talk about, politics and sports, it's interesting. You know, whose role is it to participate in sports? Is it the school's role to promote sports? Or is it something we want in youth leagues? And someone who's at, we could probably do a whole show on that alone. Because I think that I think there are some dangers taken out of the school and people that are there invested in the community. I think there's a little bit of a danger of making everything pay for play with youth sports. That eliminates a large part of the socioeconomic part of the society. If you look at even overuse and burnout injuries, they're more common in higher socioeconomic classes. You know why? Because they can pay the money to coaches and trainers and pay to overuse. It's youth sports have become a major industry.
So again, to reiterate here, James has tweeted us asking how many months of the year should a child spend playing the same sport? You're saying about 10?
Yes. I say you take 2 to 3 months off throughout the year, in 1 month increments, at least.
And so, the risk of overuse goes up when?
If you don't abide by those rules.
Okay.
So if you want to decrease your risk for overuse injuries, the two best things you can do is take adequate rest periods. Encourage sports specialization or discourage early sports specialization. And then the other thing says, I talk about sports performance all the time, and Dr. Natasha touched on two of the biggest things you can do to avoid overuse and improve your performance is adequate sleep and proper nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
I tell them, things your grandma taught you a long time ago can probably help you be a better athlete. You just got to listen to them.
It's not complicated sometimes. Nicole emailed us this concern. My 10-year-old daughter recently joined a more competitive gym and has upped her gymnastics practice from 6 hours a week to 12 hours a week. This concerns me on many levels, but she absolutely loves it, so I suspect practice will only get more intense from here. What are the main things I can do as a parent to keep her healthy? Dr. Berger, what would you say to Nicole?
I think she touched on Nicole touched on a big thing that her daughter loves it, right? So we want to support the things that our kids love, but I think taking those breaks, like we've discussed with Dr. Caney, are super important. I always encourage my high-level gymnastics ballet people, make sure that every day that you're doing something else that you love. What other hobbies do you have? You're going to be a really, really boring adult if all you can talk about is your gymnastics career when you were 12. So make sure there's other interests too. And, mm-hmm. and I think that goes kind of for all of us. We kind of get absorbed in one thing because if it's easy and it comes easy to us and we're doing it well, we get that positive feedback from it.
Yeah.
But also challenging us with diversification and doing something new. And that's important with the taking the day a week off. And for some of my families, we talk about when school, again, school is your job. And so when school and those academic requirements start to get compromised because you're spending 12 hours a week in the gym, that's when we start to have hard conversations.
We really haven't had a conversation yet about banging my head on the rim when I would dunk over and over again in high school. The big knot I used to have on my head. I'd like to get to that at some point, too.
Could explain a lot there,
yeah.
Steve. So,
yeah.
And I have to say,
isn't that the truth?
And the rule we use, I use a lot with families, is just the one, you know, kind of an easy rule is how much should my child be practicing per week? What should they be doing?
Right.
And, you know, my kids love it. What I tell them is, I'm thankful. Today's my wife's birthday, and so my kids love birthday cake. And so, but they would eat it all day long if I would let them. My role as a parent sometimes is to not allow them to just do everything that they love.
Yes.
And provide, you know, maybe some, in my case, different nutrition, but in other ways also some different exposure, different sports to create a well-rounded individual. And what we usually say as a rule of thumb is in that your child should not be involved in practice or activity. It should not add up to more. The hours per week should equal their age. So if you have a 10-year-old, they shouldn't practice or play more than 10 hours per week.
That's interesting.
I forgot to write down how old her daughter was, but I would use that as a rule. So say, okay.
10-year-old.
10-year-old. So I would kind of set as a rule, and as they age, looking, maintaining about that 10-hour per week rule. And that's an easy thing for parents to follow.
Well, my little story about banging my head in the rim so often was sort of a prelude to this notion of concussions we haven't gotten to yet. Big concern in the world of sports at the professional level, at the amateur level. What's an update on concussion and concussion protocol these days? A lot new there?
Concussion's always evolving, and it's amazing. We've talked about sports for 45 minutes into the show now. We haven't talked about concussion because it's in the headlines every day.
Every day.
And so, I think it's hard for families because there's so much media attention out there that they're getting bombarded from tiny studies in many cases, you know, involving 10 and 12 athletes out of the millions that play. And so 10 years ago, we weren't paying much attention to concussion, and that wasn't wise. We know that. And the volume of research is just enormous now, coming in every day. But however, we don't have a lot of good outcomes on that yet. What we know over the past few years, kind of the changes I call the update in 2016, is in that we continue to know that concussions are something that need to be respected. They need to be removed from play immediately if there's any suspicion of concussion. They should not return to play until they've been thoroughly evaluated by a physician. And that then, if they are going to return to play, that they need to go through a stepwise process once they've kind of returned to their baseline status. That means, you know, I need to be back to feeling how I did before. That means if I didn't have headaches before and I still have headaches, I'm not going back to play my sport. I want to be back to the same Johnny or Susie that I was before. I need to be performing well in school. I need to be sleeping well. My schoolwork needs to be back on track. I need to have gone through these physical activity return to play process before I step foot back on the field.
It's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
Yeah. And remind people what a concussion is.
So a concussion itself is still fairly poorly defined. In that if you
just know it when you have it.
Well, I'm speaking tomorrow at the Kansas City Southwest Clinical Society, and I like to give a slide on the definition of concussion because it takes about three slides to go over. And anytime it takes three slides to go over, there's still a little debate about what exactly takes place. And so we know following a blow to the head or a force to the head. So sometimes it's a direct hit. Sometimes it's more of a whiplash-type mechanism. But that force to the head creates a temporary disturbance. We think that the brain then, like any body part that's been injured, is demanding more blood flow, but at the same time, because of the injury, less is being delivered. Mm-hmm. And so you have some axonal or neuron damage. Usually it's transient, and most people that have concussion recover and go on to do very well. And mm-hmm. so I think that's the part that I try to emphasize to families, that when properly recognized, properly managed, and properly returned back to your sport by someone with some guidance, most people do very well. The things we see in the news, for the most part, the things we've seen with a lot of our professional adult athletes, are many times folks who have had multiple events, tried to return to play without proper guidance, and kind of gotten themselves into trouble. So, because I think there is a little bit of a scare factor. People are scared to let their kids participate in any sport.
I was going to say, Dr. Berger, how often are you hearing your parents and athletes, kid athletes, ask you about concussion and how concerned are they about it? Lots of questions, I'm sure.
Tons of questions. And I think the biggest one is, do I let my kid play football? But I think...
How do you answer that question?
Well, that's a complicated question. But I think what's more important to that is, yes, we hear a lot about concussions in football, all over the headlines, just like Dr. Candy said. But I think we have to also recognize that one of the most common places that kids get concussions is on the playground and in motor vehicle accidents. So it's not just about football. It's not just about sports play. Concussions can happen kind of anywhere that your brain can hit the ground, so to speak. And so being cognizant about the importance of concussion in general is important to all families.
Whether or not
you want to play football is kind of up to you.
I've heard people say that these days we should be wearing helmets in cars. Should we?
I'd like to keep kids rear facing in the back seat until they're 2, and kids in the back seat until they're 13 before we start talking about helmets.
I like to talk about helmets a lot because I don't think there's any evidence that helmets prevent concussion. And so
that's because the brain sort of moves by itself inside the skull. The helmet doesn't really
get you there. That's the biggest part about concussion is speaking with people who are honest about what we know and honest about what we don't know.
Yeah.
And there's still so much we don't know. And I think so much of the focus is on helmets many times, which, again, I'm not convinced are going to be the long-term answer. They're on products. You know, there are a lot of products now sold to try to either test or manage concussion or tell you how fast your head was moving when you got hit. And at the end of the day, none of those products have been shown to actually prevent concussion. And the other part I tell the football is a question I get a lot. And I have 3 young girls. If any of them want to play football, I'll probably let them. Okay. But I don't think it's probably in the cards for my group. But a lot of my patients, it is. And I tell them.
If you had a son, you would let him play football?
If they had the proper coach, they had the proper strength training, their school employed an athletic trainer that was on the sideline and at all events to provide some medical just awareness. I think that should happen in any sport. If you sponsor a sport, you should have an athletic trainer. Mm-hmm. I think that should be required for club, organizations, schools.
That's
and so I'm fairly passionate about those folks being involved in sports because they actually produce better, healthier athletes. And I would let my son play sport if he wanted to. I think it is a challenging conversation, but I think it's one that you have to have, and you have to educate on what we know or don't know about the mm-hmm. sport and the risk of concussion, and you have to build awareness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what would you add to that, Natasha?
No, I completely agree. I think that's definitely a family conversation. Another question that I get a lot when we're talking about preventing concussions is doing baseline testing and having families get their kids tested, and I'd love to hear Dr. Canny's take on the importance of getting their athletes baseline tested.
It's another challenging question, because I think what I ask people is what are your goals in getting baseline tested? I think many families feel like they're protected by getting a baseline test, and a baseline test does nothing to protect you from concussion. And so I think baseline tests can be helpful in some situations, but if I have to choose, I'd rather spend 10 more minutes talking to someone and educate them about what to do if they suspect a concussion than doing a baseline test. That's a product.
We're going to leave our conversation. There's some very good advice, some very good counsel, and I appreciate it very much. Dr. Greg Canty, Medical Director of the Center for Sports Medicine over at Children's Mercy. Greg, you were great. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Natasha Burgert of Pediatric Associates of Kansas City. It's always great to have you, Natasha.
Thank you,
thanks
Steve.
Very much. Coming up, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is here, and he wants to talk about a group, Burwanger.
Burwanger is a project led by Josh Burwanger.
Yeah.
He's a longtime area emo rocker and straight-ahead rock and roller.
Emo rocker meaning?
Meaning.
You're using one of those musical terms, Bill.
One of those musical terms that means alternative rock with lyrics based on confessional emotions.
Okay, well, let's listen to a little bit of Burwanger here. This track is titled Booty Shake from the album Exorcism Rock. That's Burwanger, a Kansas City rock band led by Josh Burwanger. We'll be celebrating the release of a new album at the Record Bar on Friday. And do I hear a little Tom Petty there? Because it sounds like it to me, Bill.
It sure does. There's a lot of Tom Petty here, a little Cheap Trick as well. You know, the forthcoming album is called Exorcism Rock. And I think what he means is he's trying to expel the demons of a failed relationship. But to me, Exorcism Rock means he's trying to pretend that the last 30 years of popular music never happened.
Oh, that's interesting. So who is Burwanger?
He was in a group called The Anniversary that among indie rock aficionados was a seminal band that influenced a lot of other groups. That group recently got back together, but Josh is currently on tour promoting his new album, his new solo album.
Well, this is a pop rock song if I've ever heard one. I mean, besides Tom Petty, do we know what inspired, you know, such a happy-sounding track here?
Well, you know, he says that this album was inspired by nights of binge-drinking tequila and watching Apocalypse Now. But this
is a happy sound, considering.
But it's a happy sound, considering.
Yeah. I would not have expected a song like this to have come from those two influences, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't either, but I think this is his wheelhouse. This is how he sounds, even if there's darkness behind it.
Tell us about the show Friday at the Record Bar.
Josh is going to be releasing this new album on four different shades of vinyl, including one called Hot Pink Splatter.
Wow.
You could also buy it on CD, and he's sharing the bill with a group called Freight Train Rabbit Killers, who are releasing a comic book that night.
Wow, okay. Again, Burwanger performs at the Record Bar on Friday, October 28th, just coming up in a couple days. Bill Brownlee, thanks very much. Always good to have you here.
So glad to be here.
You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up-to-Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's program, incumbent Missouri Senator Roy Blunt will be in studio here to discuss his reelection bid. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.